Ladies and gentlemen, today is the first day of the rest of your life. And now, listen in as Tristan and Johnny bring it all to the table on the Vision Board Podcast.
Guys, welcome back. Episode 178 of the Vision Board Podcast. I'm Tristan Cannell, and alongside me, Johnny Stofko.
How's everyone doing today? Tristan, what's up? How you feeling?
I'm doing good, man. Yourself?
Rocking and rolling. Another great opportunity for us and you guys listening at home to get your learn on, because we got an educated PhD coming to the show.
Yeah, absolutely. Dr. Chris Masterjohn. It's been a while in the making, but I'm really glad that we got him on. He's a world of absolute knowledge. He's, you know, he's doing some great stuff. Looking jacked at the moment, Chris, if you're listening. I hope you are.
Yeah,
you're doing some great things, so keep that up.
I'm noticing a trend. Hopefully this is, you know, as we keep evolving as people and culture, that the whole idea of being a smart guy doesn't equate to what it used to be. You know, because we know a lot of smart guys from interviewing them with a lot of post-grad degrees who are athletes, who are aware that the importance of that, you know, muscle connection, body connection, mind connection sort of thing.
Yeah.
Chris is also, you know, we always respect guys who are also doing research and sharing it, because sometimes some of the most famous researchers, we don't find out about them until it's too late.
Yeah, just that's true.
You know what I mean? So it's good that he's putting it out there too.
Yeah, he's getting in the mainstream now, which is great. I think the more kind of...
We need that.
The credentialed sort of research that can make a difference, and he's getting a fair bit out there now too. And it's tried and tested. It's researched, and you know, it's facts because it's science. So
I like these little tips. Well, some people would argue that it's fact because it's science, because science is ever
changing. I guess science always changes, but yeah, I guess for the current time, I reckon I think that's probably made the better word. It's the where it is now.
I like what Chris for sure, and it comes from research and up to date. Like also staying in the loop on what's going on in either sports performance, if that's your thing, or nutrition is your thing, and then also doing studies and then sharing it. Chris has a cool little gig he does on his social media where he'll take his most recent kind of research thing and then put like a little quick little video up. You guys can check that out too. We'll leave the links at the end of the show.
Yeah, for sure. Guys, thanks for tuning into the show. I really appreciate you joining myself and Johnny on today's episode. If you haven't yet, please subscribe to the show via iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or you can check out all the episodes online at www.thevisionboardpodcast.com.
Get involved, guys.
All right, guys, let's get straight to it. I introduce Chris Masterjohn. All right, guys, our special guest is Chris Masterjohn. Chris is an entrepreneur in all things health and fitness and specializes in research, education, and consulting. He earns his PhD in nutritional sciences from the University of Connecticut and has served as a postdoctoral research associate and assistant professor until December 2016, where he left academia and now pursues entrepreneurship and conducting independent research. We welcome Chris Masterjohn. Chris, welcome to the podcast, mate.
Thanks for having me, mate.
Chris, what's up, man? So we literally just got off a chat with another PhD in nutrition. He specializes specifically in the fight game, MMA, UFC fighters. And I asked him a question about, you know, where he sees the biggest hole in this pro athlete's game is, and he said nutrition. And having you on, PhD in nutrition sciences, from a general population perspective, the research that you're currently doing, do you agree with that? Do you feel that overall, as a society, education in that realm is probably, you know, the most kind of, you know, spot that we could work on as people?
Well, I don't train MMA fighters, so I can't address that population. But I think in general, you know, it really depends. I think that it's certainly the missing link for a lot of people, but you know, there's a huge population of people who care deeply about nutrition, and I think it's pretty easy once you understand the power of nutrition to think that everything's about nutrition, in which case, all of a sudden, you're in a different population where your weakest link is something totally different. So it's definitely something that a lot of people need to manage, but I'm not convinced that it's the thing in the general population. I think it's maybe one of a triad of there's food, there's sleep, and then there's lifestyle management around stress and those types of things. And so definitely it's one of the big three, but you're not gonna fix 4 hours of sleep on the weekdays and 17 hours per day on the weekend with vegetables.
Yeah, I grew up in Northeast Ohio, and I've been in Australia for about 4 years. Every time I go back, I was back in June, and I'm sitting at an airport in Cleveland, and I'm looking around, and now obviously the population in America is going to be bigger than Australia, but it just seems to me that there is almost so many people are just comfortable with being uncomfortable in regards to their body weight, and it seems like it's like bad momentum to get people overweight. Like, it's like one decision led to this decision, then you get to a point in your life where you're just kind of like, screw it, and now the whole house of cards has collapsed. With that sort, is that lack of education, in your opinion? Do you think that that's resources? Do you think that that's marketing? You posted on your Instagram the Macy's Day Parade, and it's a McDonald's clown floating through a parade promoting like hydrogenated oils and obesity. What's your opinion on that, and how can we fix that?
Yeah, well, so first of all, I want to back up, and I can't believe that I just listed those three things without mentioning exercise. So, right, yeah. So it's a big four things, right? There's sleep, stress, food, and exercise. Anyway, Ronald, I don't know. I took a picture of every float at the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, and I was like, geez, what should I post on my Instagram? And my Instagram is nutrition. And so I'm not going to apologize to our dear friend Ronald about this, but like that was the real motivation to taking one of my photos and posting it. Like, Ronald McDonald was just the most nutrition related thing. I don't know. I mean, even McDonald's, you know, if you go, I don't know what it's like down under, but when I was traveling in Europe, McDonald's had a totally different image there than in the United States, where they were really trying to promote themselves as like the hipster cafes in some of the European cities that I was visiting. And I've never been to Greece, but from what I've heard in Greece, McDonald's fries everything in olive oil. And so, I mean, they're really responding to the culture. I think they just care about money. And McDonald's was formed in an era where there was not very much health consciousness among the population. Everyone was interested in convenience, and that's, you know, people are still interested in convenience. I'm interested in convenience, but it was, you know, there was another era where just making the food more convenient was the only thing anyone cared about.
Yeah.
And so I think McDonald's was responding to that. They realized they could make a ton of money if they just exploited that vulnerability in the culture that they saw. And now the tide is turning. People are more interested in sustainability. People are more interested in healthy eating. People are more interested in cutting out the hydrogenated oils. And, you know, McDonald's is just going to put their finger to the wind. And when they feel like it's advantageous for them from a profit perspective, they're going to start changing that. So, I mean, these companies do cause a lot of harm in the sense that If you do view it as your most profitable opportunity to exploit a particular vulnerability in the population, you may exaggerate that, right? If people only care about convenience, then you can be the one that delivers the convenience, but you just might be the one to take it to the next level where you get the next doubling of convenience at the expense of doubling the adverse health consequences. So they are a culprit, kind of, but I don't know, we're all kind of complicit in that. But anyway, to answer your question about the education, I think that's part of it, but part of it is, you know, you can be really educated and not act on anything that you know. Yeah. And I mean, there's a lot of nutrition professors who are pretty fat.
Yeah,
it
sure.
Doesn't have to be, you know what I mean?
Like, yeah,
it's a combination of education and value and learning to execute on, you have to know something, but you also have to value it. You have to value it to bother learning it. But you also have to value it to hold on to that knowledge. And then you got to execute on that knowledge. And that might take motivation. It might take accountability. there's so many personalities that it really just, for each person, you know, for each person, they're unhealthy because lack of resources. They're unhealthy because wrong priorities. They're unhealthy because no accountability, and they need to make a public bet. You know, like, it's just different for each person.
Yeah, that education part, since you've left academia, have you found it easier to apply a lot of the principles that you have learned, both to yourself and on now an entrepreneurial side, to clients that hire you?
Yeah, but only because I left academia for something that gave me more freedom over my schedule instead of less. So I could have easily left academia for, in academia, you have more freedom over your schedule than in almost any other job. It's really only the freedom over my schedule that has allowed me to put into place the things that I need to be healthy, because, you know, for me, a lot of it is just priorities. If I'm working for someone where, like in academia, for example, you have a class schedule, yeah, and you have a lot of freedom over how to design that class. You have a lot of freedom to dictate where you're going to be, whether you're going to be in your office or you're going to be in a cafe or you're going to be at home when you're designing your lessons. But there's a pretty strict schedule where you have a lot of deadlines, where if you don't show up to class with lesson ready, that class falls apart, and the 30 people who are counting on you to have that lesson together, their day's wrecked as well as yours. And so to feel like all your students are counting on you to have everything done by a certain time, but then also to have the perfectionist tendencies that I do, that means that I'm stuck sacrificing all the other priorities in my life because I feel like that is the most imminent thing that needs to be done, not working out, not preparing dinner right, and all those other things slide for me. So yeah, now that I've left academia and I have total control over my schedule, it's a lot easier for me to design my lifestyle around meeting my health goals. For other people, it would be different, right? A lot of other people do well on a 9-to-5 and have no problem saying, I'm going to go to the gym at 7 and then I'm going to take a shower and go to work. I can't operate like that, but other people can. So it's not really leaving academia. It's really, finding the right thing for me personally and individually to thrive. And that's what I've done.
Chris, what I'm learning from, you know, from being a strength coach, is that there is a common denominator with people struggling with the relationship with food. And recently I have a client specifically, and I need her to gain weight, and I need, you know, she reached out to me, she's a newer client, and I'm struggling with like the mental barriers that she has created and how she looks at her food, whether being healthy or unhealthy. And a lot of these things that she feels are healthy just aren't healthy. They're not really high nutritious foods. So from your perspective, have you ever struggled with weight? Have you ever struggled with your relationship with food? And advice to myself and coaches listening to the show who have clients with that mental barrier, what advice would you give us?
I don't feel like I've struggled with my relationship with food. I feel like I've struggled a lot with my relationship with work. And if I've, like, my first semester as a faculty in the university system, I put 7 inches on my waist. Mm. And, you know, some people might look at that and say I had an unhealthy relationship with food, but I would dispute that. I had an unhealthy relationship with work, and that may have led me to make choices as a result of that, food choices that I felt that I needed to, that made me get fat, but it really sprung from my relationship with my workaholism and how I was applying, you know, what I was saying before, when you mix those overwhelming deadlines with a personality that's driven by perfectionism, it's just it's a recipe for a pathological level of sacrificing everything for that work. And that was my issue. Now, there's definitely people who have unhealthy relationships with food. Man, I don't know if I'm really the one to tell you. I do a lot of consulting, but the consulting that I do is not really coaching. I'm not that good at, like, I can understand someone's problems with food when they tell me about them, but I'm not really the person who looks at the way someone operates and then figures out how to talk to them in a way that's going to change their relationship with food. I'm really good at analyzing things and solving problems, but you know, it, like if me and you were going to collaborate on an issue like this, I wouldn't be the guy telling you how to talk to this person to change their perception about what's healthy. I'd be the guy analyzing the diet to say, well, maybe she should be eating this instead of that.
Yeah, I was looking at your website and, you know, a common question we get asked a lot is like what supplements to take, what vitamins to take. And one of them popped up that on your website that I'm not familiar with. And I wanted to ask you to share some insight on vitamin K2. And, you know, for people listening, the importance of having that in your diet.
Yeah, so vitamin K2 is a specific form of vitamin K that is a lot better. I should back up. So vitamin K is a fat-soluble vitamin that's found in animal foods and plant foods. Plant foods contain vitamin K1, animal foods, as well as plant foods that have been fermented by bacteria contain vitamin K2. And vitamin K2 is better at getting into your blood vessels and your bones than vitamin K1 is. And your blood vessels and your bones use vitamin K2 to make a variety of proteins that do some really important things. One of those things is to make sure that your calcium gets into your bones and teeth, where it makes your bones and teeth strong and it makes your teeth resistant to cavities, and stays out of your kidneys, where the calcium makes kidney stones, and stays out of your blood vessels, where it contributes to heart disease. So that right there is protecting you from tooth decay, osteopenia, osteoporosis, and kidney stones and heart disease. That's a bunch of things right there. It does some other things. One of those is it makes a hormone called osteocalcin. Osteocalcin helps you regulate your blood sugar properly. It helps you regulate your sex hormones properly. It's good for your fertility. And you might be interested in this as a strength coach. It's actually been shown recently that one of the things that osteocalcin does is when you exercise, it's released from your bones where it's made, and it acts on your adipose tissue, your fat storage. It acts on your liver to release fatty acids and glucose into the bloodstream, and then it acts on your skeletal muscle to help take up the glucose and fatty acids at a higher than normal rate and burn it for energy. So basically, vitamin K2 is making you make this hormone that not only helps you stabilize your blood sugar and optimize your fertility, but it also is a critical component of how you burn fuel at a higher rate when you exercise.
Yeah, what's the best way in terms of foods or maybe even a supplement that K2 is in?
So one of the problems with K2, and one of the reasons why I felt it was valuable to write so much about it, is that most people probably aren't getting enough. If you look at the standard diet, the K2 is mostly coming from egg yolks and cheese. Okay. If you look more broadly at where to get it, it's present in a lot of obscure foods. So in eastern Japan, there's a food called natto, and natto is fermented soybeans. It makes kind of a smelly product that makes everything it touches really sticky. So it's kind of a cultural, it's kind of like a acquired taste that works in some cultures. It doesn't work that well in other cultures. And so, you know, most people in Australia, most people in Europe, most people in the United States are not eating natto, but it happens to be the best source of vitamin K2 in the entire world. And then the second best source is goose liver. But again, culturally, most people aren't eating goose liver. And so if you're in the position where you're getting a modest amount from egg yolks and cheese, or maybe you believe that egg yolks and cheese are bad for you because egg yolks are high in cholesterol and cheese is high in saturated fat, so you're not eating egg yolks and cheese, then you might not be getting enough, and you should think about adding a supplement. And if you go to chrismasterjohnphd.com/K2, I have the ultimate K2 resource, and that has supplement recommendations. I would just say, to make it simple, if you search for vitamin K2 supplements, then there's usually two forms. One is called MK4 and one's called MK7. Yep. I think it's best to get something that has both of those in it because, we haven't gone into all the details, but basically you can further divide vitamin K2 in a bunch of different forms, and the different forms provide different benefits. So it's best to just get cover all the bases and get the more forms you get, the better.
Yeah, and just keeping on supplements, in terms of what you're using and the recommendations that you use for your clients, what supplements are those key sort of core ones that you always include?
I don't ever do that. So where I would start is you should design your diet so that it doesn't need any supplements. And I think there's a handful of principles to try to do that. One of those principles is, first of all, get enough protein. So everyone should be eating at least you guys work in kilograms, huh?
That's right.
I would say everyone should be eating at least a gram or even 1.2 grams of protein per kilogram body weight.
Yep.
Maybe up to double that in pounds, like a half a gram to a gram of protein per pound of body weight, somewhere around there. And if you take that protein and you diversify the protein among various sources of animal protein, so you have some meat, you have some fish, if you tolerate it, you have some shellfish, you have some eggs, you have some dairy, right there, the diversification of that protein supply is really helping you get your nutrients. And so, like, some of your listeners maybe think from an economic perspective, you diversify your investment portfolio. It's the same exact thing. When you're diversifying your foods, you're diversifying the benefits, right? So eggs have some nutrients that steak doesn't have. Steak has some that fish doesn't have. And so by diversifying, you're getting the full spectrum of benefits. And then also, every food has something about it that's bad. And so you're diverse, you're spreading around that risk so that there's no too much risk in one area. So you diversify your proteins. That's principle one. The next principle is you try to eat nose to tail. And what that means is that in the modern era, we've become accustomed to eating things like skinless, boneless chicken breast. Well, there's nutrients in the skin that aren't in the breast. And there's nutrients in the bone that aren't in the meat. And there's nutrients in the liver that aren't in the muscle meat or the breast. And so what you want to do is try to eat organ meats and try to use bones. And if you're to pick one way to do that, I'd say eating liver once a week and using bones to make things like broths and gravies in the traditional ways that our grandparents did are ways to do that. You can go even further. You know, you can eat the heart, you can eat the kidneys. But if you're going to pick an organ, liver is really where you get the most bang for the buck. So that's principle two, is eat nose to tail. Principle three would be eat a large volume of fruits and vegetables and include at least a couple servings of green leaves a day. And then principle four would be diversify your carbohydrate sources and among different types of starches. So if you have you could just eat bread, right? But instead of just eating bread, if you eat some legumes and you eat some starchy tubers like potatoes and you eat fruit, et cetera, if you diversify across those carbohydrate sources, you're getting the same benefits in a different, in a different set of foods as the way we talked about diversifying your meat sources. And then principle five would be, in all these foods, you want to mostly eat whole foods and not junk foods, right? So when I say diversify your starches, for example, that doesn't mean eat refined wheat bread and eat refined tapioca starch, and there you go. It means, you know, you can include some whole grains, but also include all these other whole foods, right? Like all the white stuff, you kind of cut it out. And I think if you hit those five principles, there aren't any universally applicable supplements because you're pretty much getting everything you need from food. And then the supplementation comes down to a case-by-case basis. So it depends what your goals are and depends what your problems are. If you have someone who doesn't have any problems, then they might not need any supplements. But, hey, maybe they have a big goal of improving their athletic performance, and it might make a lot of sense for them to be supplementing with creatine. right? Because it's a well-established performance enhancer. On the other hand, maybe you have someone who's complaining about anxiety all the time. Well, that might call for a certain set of supplements, but it might be a totally different set of supplements than someone who's complaining about skin problems, right? Or dry eyes, right? So for those things, you really need to understand nutrition enough where you can act like a detective. And so you need to think, and you also have to optimize for your clients a little bit around cost-benefit analysis. So I have some clients who have enough money to run testing to get firmer conclusions, so they spend less time guessing. I have other clients who want to help me narrow down what kind of testing they want to do or try to figure out things without testing because their goal is to save money. That's a different way of approaching it. But either way, you have to say, okay, what are the resources that we have to figure out what's best for this individual person, either to better fulfill their goals or to better solve their problems? And you really, I really do think you need to be able to, there's a lot of people where maybe it's really, really simple and you have kind of a cookie cutter approach. But in my case, I work with a lot of clients who have harder problems that other people haven't solved and they're hard even for me to solve. And I'm usually thinking a lot like a detective to try to figure out, okay, they have this problem. It seems to be resistant to the usual things. What blood work can we run? How can we use these signs and symptoms to figure out what might be missing? And a supplementation protocol is going to follow on the heels of those decisions.
What's up, guys? Be sure to pick up your free copy of Conversations with Champions. This is our free ebook, which is comprised of inspirational quotes from past guests that we've had on the show.
Get inspirational quotes from champions such as Evander Holyfield, Jonathan Thurston, Grant Cardone, Gary Vee, Larry Holmes, Mario Andretti, Anthony Mundine, Joe DeFranco, and many, many more.
To pick up your free copy now, just simply go to our website, www.divisionboardpodcast.com/ebook. Put your name and email in the slot. It takes about 10 seconds, and we'll send you the book directly to your inbox. Now back to the show. When you're looking for those markers with your clients trying to, you know, problem solve, how important is like inflammation? I was reading this book called The Anti-Cancer Diet, and the writer was highlighting the fact that he was now this is super simply explaining this. I apologize for the brevity, but he was explaining that certain foods cause inflammations, and then the inflammation will cause abnormal cell growth, and then it just puts you in just a bigger window if you're sedentary, you don't work out, all these like the storm brew basically of making yourself sick. Do you check the inflammation? Is that one of your key markers when you're trying to figure those problems out with your clients?
I would look for inflammation that's not supposed to be there. So I this is kind of my shtick to harp on this, but inflammation is a fundamentally good thing. Mm. And I think it's really important to make that distinction, because if you didn't have it, you'd be dead. And I think the reason that that's important is that we don't really have epidemic levels of too much inflammation. We have epidemic levels of dysregulated inflammation. And when you think about that differently, you start to think differently about what to do about that. Because you're supposed to get in. And actually, it has other implications too, right? If you look at the strength conditioning world, there's post-exercise inflammation. Mm. There's people taking non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, NSAIDs, over-the-counter anti-inflammatories, as a post-workout cooling of that inflammation. And inflammation is good, and it's supposed to be there. What your strategy around that should be to let it happen, right? So because it's playing an important role in your recovery and remodeling and everything. So, I mean, you're going to be a better athlete if you don't try to interfere with that process. The even worse part about it is those over-the-counter anti-inflammatory drugs interfere with the resolution of inflammation as much as they quell the peak inflammation. And I actually think the reason a lot of people have chronic unresolved inflammation is because they're taking a bunch of drugs that interfere with the normal regulatory processes around that. So there's really compelling evidence that when you're taking over-the-counter anti-inflammatory drugs, I should back up. So the normal course of inflammation response to something is to increase, hit a peak, go down, and return to normal. If you take an anti-inflammatory drug, generally what happens is you go up to a lower peak so it doesn't seem as bad, but then you never fully return down to normal and you get stuck in that middle space where you have kind of sort of inflammation. And I would say if there's an epidemic of anything, it's being stuck in that middle space where it kind of sort of has some inflammation, but you don't have enough that you're in the hospital. You don't have enough that you're diagnosed with an inflammatory disorder, but you just got a little inflammation all the time. And that's not a problem. Inflammation is bad. That's a problem. You're throwing a bunch of stuff in your body that's dysregulating how your body normally regulates inflammation. And you're in this really weird spot where your body doesn't know what the heck is going on. And that's where you really don't want to be. So I'm a little bit skeptical of the idea that people are eating lots of stuff that causes inflammation. I think that's, you know, it's true on a case-by-case basis. Like, there's people who have allergies to almost everything, and that causes inflammation. There's people who you wouldn't call celiac disease an allergy, but celiac disease is an inflammatory response to gluten, and people who have celiac disease, the best thing they can do to get rid of that abnormal inflammation is to get rid of gluten. And, you know, there's lots of different cases like that. Non-celiac gluten intolerance is a similar case that applies to a broader number of people, but there's no universally inflammatory foods. But there are lots of things that lots of people do that prevent inflammation from coming to an end when it should. And on those notes, I would say the most important things to do are the number one thing to do is to not do anything to try to inhibit inflammation with either over-the-counter drugs or really high doses of fish oil. And I'm not saying if you're in debilitating pain, don't take anything. I'm just saying don't take these drugs because it's your pain is inconvenient, right? Like if you got a mild headache and it's not debilitating you, like let it slide. If you're recovering from an injury, actually, you will recover best if you try not to take painkillers. Again, if it's debilitating, don't wreck your life over an ideological opposition to painkillers. But don't take painkillers just because you're a little more comfortable when you do. You're really messing unnecessarily with the regulation of inflammation when you do that stuff. And then what you do get is important. So the biggest things that are most important to get are a fatty acid called arachidonic acid, which is best found in egg yolks and liver, a fatty acid called DHA, which is found in egg yolks if they're from chickens raised on pasture, and is also found in fatty fish. So eating fish, especially fatty fish, like one or two or three times a week can be really helpful. And vitamin A, which if you eat liver once a week, you get all the vitamin A you need. If some people are really good at getting vitamin A from plant food, so eating a lot of colorful vegetables helps. Some people aren't. And if you're not eating liver once a week, actually you can't come back to supplements, right? Like if you can't meet those recommendations I was making before, you should probably take a supplement. And if you can't eat liver once a week, or you can't, you don't take cod liver oil as a substitute, you should probably be getting some supplemental vitamin A because you might not be getting what you need. And I think those are the biggest things to think about for inflammation.
Are you familiar with Dr. Rhonda Patrick?
I am.
I wanted to talk about on recovery, her study, you know, hypothermic conditioning, her whole study on using the dry sauna for recovery. What's your knowledge on that? And for people listening, because a lot of coaches and clients listen to the show, on using the dry sauna for recovery.
So I can't speak to that really because I have not, I'm familiar with Rhonda Patrick and I do follow her work, but I have not like done any independent research on that topic.
She basically tracked for, I think, a 5-year study on centenarians, so cultures that live to 100. And she found that a common denominator in those cultures were implementing dry heat. So, and then her whole study was based on athletes who train, and then at that state, after you work out, you sit in extreme dry heat for an extended amount of time. She talks about the body producing heat shock proteins in that state, which then will help reduce the inflammation. And back to my question, because you kind of just blew me away with, I never knew that inflammation, now coming from a strength perspective, is part of the, you said it's part of the process. So taking like an anti-inflammatory is kind of like not allowing that process to come full circle. Is that, am I off base with that, or is that correct?
That is correct. So let me ask you, I mean, I guess you're more familiar with what Dr. Patrick has done on this than I am. So is there any data showing that enhances metrics that you would be concerned about specifically as an athletic coach and not as someone interested in health and longevity? For example, is there any evidence that you grow bigger muscles or that you have lower recovery time to get more performance when you use that technique?
So yeah, in her first release, because she just released part two a couple weeks ago, the first one came out, I think, 4 years ago, and she talks about the body. Now, this was specifically studying just males, by the way, as well, listening at home. She said that the body then produces our natural growth hormone by an extra 200% when you're inflamed while you're in that extreme dry heat right after that workout. And I just found that fascinating.
Right. Yeah. That's really cool. But what I'm asking you is, are there any, like, that's a mechanistic thing, right? Mm-hmm. So what I'm asking you is there any actual data on like hypertrophy or performance, right? So a study where if you use this technique, you grow bigger muscles in response to the same workout, or when you use this technique, like you can go run your 5K faster with resting less time after your last workout, or like something along those lines.
Yeah,
is there anything like that?
No, maybe I don't want to say no. I kind of just, you know, when we research or we read things, we attach to the main points. But that's an awesome perspective as well. I'll have to relook into that and send you a message.
So let me just say a couple things in general then. And to be clear, I'm not speaking in, you know, obviously neither of us are familiar with the details needed to discuss this specific technique. But as a general principle, one of the things that is often lacking in perspective on any research in athletic performance is that there's a lot of surrogate markers that are thought to reflect some process. But in fact, the thing you actually care about is a reflection of the net effect of many processes. And sometimes we make an assumption that one thing leads to something, but we're losing those other things. A great example of this is there's a lot of research showing that something affects muscle protein synthesis. And the answer to that is, who cares? The only people who care are academics that want to understand mechanism. Because if you have increased muscle protein synthesis, but you also have increased muscle protein breakdown, you don't get any more muscle growth, right? So like the bodybuilder wants to know, how do I increase the circumference around this area or something like that? Like actual muscle hypertrophy is the end objective when you're doing those studies. And looking at muscle protein synthesis or muscle protein breakdown is mechanistic. But because net hypertrophy is a combination, is the net effect of these processes, we don't know, right? So growth hormone, for example, like affects various mechanistic processes involved in how you handle your energy and other hormones that go into like eventually fitting together into some kind of recovery metric or performance metric or hypertrophy metric. But if you haven't actually measured something like, you exercised on day one, did you perform better on day two? Or did you have to take a shorter rest to get the same performance on day two or measurement two or whatever? You know, if you're not measuring that, you don't actually know whether you're recovering better and or performing better. So in this case, my general perspective, and I'm totally willing to, number one, acknowledge that I haven't seen all the data on all the various techniques. And number two, I'm totally willing to change my mind if I encounter the data, and maybe the data needed to change my mind is out there. But right now, based on what I have seen, my opinion is that cold stress and heat stress are basically going to be more catabolic in nature in general, and are more on the they have the capacity to be used in a way that might promote extra recovery, but they could interfere with recovery depending on how they're timed. And so I really don't know about the heat stress issue, but I know that number one, there has been research showing that cold stress after a muscle protein workout seems to, in the short term, hurt the recovery you need to build muscle from that workout. And that if you're going to do cold stress, at least you probably shouldn't do it right after you work out. And there's also studies showing that a lot of the things that you do want to do, like replete your glycogen after your workout, are done best when you're in a very comfortable environment. So for example, like put the AC on to like 67 or like whatever is most comfortable to you is probably where you're going to have maximal recovery. So I think one of the things that we need to keep in mind is that when you're talking about exercise, you're trying to get an adaptive response to a stress. So there's lots of room to make things more stressful in order to get a better adaptive response. But you can't lose sight of the fact that when you actually get fit is when you are lazy, having fun, sleeping, and eating, right? So like you go to the gym and you make your workout really hard. Maybe you also do heat stress. Maybe you also do cold stress. Maybe you also do whatever. Maybe you do your workout fasted. Like there's lots of different ways to enhance the stimulus, but it's not the stimulus that makes you fit. It's adapting that stimulus once the stimulus has left its mark, but is no longer leaving its mark, and you're now in comfortable conditions where you can repair yourself. So we do want to find out ways to put lots of stresses on the body, but we cannot lose sight of the fact that you recover when you get home and you say, you know what, I'm done working out. I'm gonna be like max comfortable. I'm gonna do something fun, rest, relax, wind down, take a big nap after eating a lot of food, or like whatever it is. It's in that period of recovery, and you need to turn that recovery on too. So I think, you know, maybe work hard, play hard is the best way to summarize that. It's just don't forget to play hard is my thing.
Yeah, sure. Hey, Chris, in your research and all the clients you've come across, in terms of 6 small meals or 7 or 8 small meals across a day versus 2 to 3 large meals for someone to take in a day, is there any difference at all?
I think your blood sugar is more stable with more meals, but I don't think it, but I mean, whether that matters kind of depends on how much food you're eating and what the composition of your meals is. So if you're eating real low carb, you can probably hack your way into, like if you're eating a ketogenic diet, for example, you probably don't need to worry about blood sugar stability. But yeah. if you're eating like net caloric balance, you probably don't need to worry that much either. But if you have somebody who's trying to pack on muscle and they're eating more food than required and they're eating a carb-heavy diet, then you're probably a lot better off eating more frequent, smaller meals. So in my recent period where I've been packing on some muscle lately, and it's kind of chilled out right now. I'm putting on a little bit, but not too much. But a month or two ago, I was eating 4,000 calories a day, and my body, I just jolted my body like super into anabolic mode where I was gaining 1.75 pounds of muscle a week and 1/4 pound of fat for a few weeks. Yeah. And I definitely found that I needed to eat 5 meals a day because I was getting symptoms of blood sugar swings if I would try. Like, you just can't. I mean, first of all, if you're eating high carb, like there's only so much insulin you can make at a time, right? So if you sit down and eat 150 grams of carbs in a sitting, that's a lot of stress in your pancreas. Maybe you can handle it, but you probably can't handle it all the time. And if you can break that down into 275-gram loads, that's way easier for your body to handle. And so I just found that when I'm eating that much food, in order to avoid putting too much for my body to handle in at once, it's way better to spread it out. But at the end of the day, you know, if it's not a blood sugar concern, if it's not affecting your appetite or psychology in a way that's changing you to change how much net food you eat, If you're just talking about weight loss or building muscle, it's really more about the net average.
I like what you're doing with the master class with Master John. And I want to talk just real quick about metabolism, because it's one of these questions I think for the general population, we hear it a lot. Oh, he has a quick metabolism or she has a slow metabolism. And then I was thinking to myself, and you know, with your master class with Master John, guys listening, you've compiled like little small audio streaming files for things specifically like this that people could go on and listen to. But we use metabolism a lot. I couldn't define it. I had to go to a dictionary, and I see a lot of coaches use it. I was struggling with it to define it. I was doing a Facebook Live, and somebody had asked me, and it just, I wrote into my notes, and now having you sitting with me, what is it? How would you define to the average person what actually one's metabolism is, and why is it important?
Well, it depends whether you want a technical definition or you're trying to say what is that person talking about when they use a colloquial phrase like that. So technically speaking, metabolism is the sum of anabolism and catabolism. Anabolism is building things up and catabolism is breaking things down. So metabolism is really the sum of all chemical reactions in your body that use up or release energy. And why it's important depends on what your goals are. So if your goal is to lean out, then why it's important is totally different than if your goal is to become
weight?
A good nutrition coach or strength coach. If you want to teach people and coach people, then it's important that you understand how things work in the body. If you want to lean out, lose weight, it's only important to know what to do. So I guess I would say the importance when you were talking before about a fast metabolism or a slow metabolism, people are really talking about some people have a higher net energy expenditure than other people do, or they might be talking about their basal metabolic rate. So some people at rest burn more energy than other people do. And so some people may seem to eat a lot of food and it doesn't go anywhere and they don't have to work out to stay lean. And then other people feel like they eat something and it goes right to their hips and then they got to go to the gym to burn it off. And, that's the perception, and it's reflecting the reality that some people burn more energy at rest than other people do. And some people burn more energy when they do the same workout than other people do. And the reason that it's important for someone who wants to lose weight to understand that is that you can't assume that what works for someone else will work for you, and you can't assume that anything that causes weight loss is going to cause weight loss in you unless you calibrate your caloric intake correctly. And you may be able to calibrate your caloric intake intuitively by saying, well, I'm just going to eat this set of foods and my appetite's going to take care of it.
Yeah.
But a lot of people need to calibrate it with more work by tracking what they're doing and figuring out more in a more tedious and rigorous way how much food they should be eating.
Is it bro science? Because I always see it. We'll say that he's 26, 27, and, you know, shitty diet, but in shape. And I always hear, it's like, how could you eat that? You eat McDonald's, I never see you eat Whole Foods. Oh, I have a fast metabolism. And it's kind of like a regurgitated response, but I think with an unknowing of what that actually means. And that was kind of the gist of why I brought it up, to kind of like, what is that when people say, is that true? Is that why
Well, it's nowhere near as bad as when people say that they want to tone their muscles they really mean is they want more definition, which is caused by losing fat. It has nothing to do with muscle tone.
Yeah.
What's that?
Or when people, I want to build lean muscle. It's like, hold on.
Yeah,
like the idea
it at least is based in the reality that people do have different metabolic rates. I mean, that's true. As to whether that's why someone can eat a crappy diet, well, I don't know. I mean, there's different definitions of crappy diet. I mean, are you saying that the person's eating 3,700 calories and they should only be able to eat 2,700? Like, if that's the case, then a faster metabolic rate makes sense. But if you're saying that person's teeth should be rotting out if they're eating sugar and they're not, then that's a totally different matter. So, or even fat, like if you think, well, that person doesn't eat vegetables and they eat cake, it's not necessarily because they have fast metabolism. It might just be that they don't eat enough cake to get fat, right? So you don't get fat because you ate cake. You get fat because you ate more calories than you expended. And most people would eat fewer calories if they ate vegetables than if they ate cake. But some people, either because their appetites work well or because they're really good at cognitively controlling what they do, will only eat enough cake that they meet their caloric needs. And that person's not going to get fat. Now, that person might, their teeth might rot out. Mm-hmm. But then again, if they don't, the person might say, hey, I just got hard teeth. That's reflecting some reality that some people are more vulnerable to tooth decay than others are. Like every problem that you can have, there's some variation in the genes, in the bacteria, in the mouth, and in the gut, and on the skin, and everywhere else, in the last 20 years of the person's nutrition, and what their parents were eating when, you know, leading up to pregnancy, what the mother was eating during pregnancy. Like, there's all these things that come together to dictate your vulnerability to something going wrong. And so if you don't know what it is, you're probably going to make up something like, oh, I got a fast metabolism or something like that. But it is a reality that some people can eat more than other people and not get fat. It's just that why that is something that there's probably a lot of different reasons in different cases, and it's an ongoing thing of scientific study. But you don't know the science just because you're the guy who doesn't get fat.
Well, Chris, we've run out of time, but we really appreciate all of the insights. It was like I was at a class today, man.
It was awesome, man.
I learned a lot today.
I still have so much to ask, but we ran out of time. I wanted to touch base on cholesterol.
We'll get you back on for sure.
Yeah, round two.
Yeah, for sure.
Before we let you go, Chris, everyone get following Chris online. He's www.chrismasterjohnphd.com. Facebook and Twitter, you can find him at Chris Masterjohn.
Thanks a lot,
don't
Chris, man. We appreciate it.
On the Snapchat, man.
Are you on the Snapchat?
What's your Snapchat, man?
It's at Chris Masterjohn and everything. I make it simple for you guys.
Awesome, man.
Is that where you do your most posting, on the Snapchat?
No, I've been slacking on Snapchat, honestly. But hey, that Instagram post that you saw from a couple days ago with Neil muscled up, that I took that on Snapchat.
Is it?
That one on Snapchat first.
Okay.
Sorry, gonna get it out to the ladies first.
My gym photos always wind up on Snapchat first.
All right. And then, because Tristan introduced you, he'd use the word research and you're a researcher. Are you kind of doing like self-experimentation on yourself by bodybuilding and researching what works and what doesn't sort of thing?
Yeah. I mean, everything that I do, I collect data on some way or another because of my personality. But I'm not building muscle as an experiment.
Okay.
I'm building muscle because I want more muscle mass.
Awesome, man. Yeah, Chris, man, keep up the great work, man. We appreciate what you're doing. Thanks for doing this with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. It was fun.
And Johnny, that was Chris Masterjohn, man.
Yeah, man. It's really good to sit down with guys like Chris, Dr. Jose, Corey Peacock, The years that they put into studying their craft, and then also the work that they're currently doing in conversations like this that they're giving back and sharing with everybody, I think helps push everything forward in health and well-being and things that we're really into that our listeners are really into.
Yeah, I got a lot out of that episode. I'm sure that people have to go re-listen to get a few different tips and tricks. I really appreciate Chris coming on the show and sharing his education. That was kind of like a master class, a master's sort of degree class.
No pun intended.
It was good.
Chris Masterjohn.
You don't get access to an hour with a doctor.
That's right.
Someone that well-credentialed. So, Chris, we really appreciate your time, man.
Yeah, and this was one of those things where you and I had to be persistent and also patient because, guys, when we release these episodes with whoever it is, whoever the guest is, it rarely ever will go smoothly in terms of the scheduling. There's always reach out to them early, see where their schedule, see where our schedule is going to be at. So it always feels good when, we overcome that adversity. We get to sit down with the guests. We get to share their stories. And then we also get to learn, and as you guys do as well.
Yeah, for sure. All right, guys. Next week, we've got Siri Susan Bennett coming on, so that should be a good one, something different. So stay tuned for that one.
Siri, Susan Bennett, he said. iPhone, that's crazy.
Yeah, check out your iPhone if you want to know her voice. Switch it into American mode and you'll know exactly who she is.
You like her voice, don't you?
I've never actually heard it.
Oh, yeah. That's one thing we'll have to learn in that upcoming episode. I thought it was just a universal.
Nice.
I thought it was a computer. I didn't know it was a human.
Yeah, it's been switched around, I guess. You're going to have
flipped
to have
over front
yeah,
back.
A few different nationalities and things like that. I guess it'd be weird if an Australian had an American and an American had an Australian. But I guess you probably could do it.
You could do that generic computer voice.
It's funny when we try like a Chinese or Indian or something in a different
Do you want to give it a
manner.
Go?
Nah.
Do you want to give it a go?
Nah, they got,
are you an expert in voice?
Nah, I've got really bad accents, man. I don't want to put them down. Mexican one would be pretty cool.
Let me hear it.
Nah, I haven't got any.
You know you do.
I just like listening to it.
Which one do you go to? If you had a mimic one, what would you say your best mimic voice would be?
I don't know.
Guys, we're not trying to do cultural appropriation here. We're just trying to have fun. Do you
I
have one?
I think I have a tough enough time speaking Australian, mate. So.
Yeah, for sure. You do Australian pretty well.
Yeah, any judge.
Do you speak French?
No, I don't speak, but I can understand it.
Your bloodline is Mauritian.
Mauritian, yeah.
French colonized, right? Your pops, do they speak pidgin there?
No, they speak Creole there.
Creole there. That's interesting.
That's just like a slang version of French.
No, they speak Creole in Louisiana.
Yeah, of course.
In the bayou. New Orleans, which is crazy that this little piece of the world in the middle of the ocean where you're from had that much pull to come all the way there.
Yeah, interesting. Beautiful city.
Does your mom or dad speak it?
Yeah, both of them speak it.
Give me a sentence. I want to hear what it sounds like.
No, I just couldn't pull it.
Well, maybe we should bring Pops on.
Yeah, maybe he can come on. Good job, man, for sure. All right, guys. Really appreciate you joining in the show, Johnny's social media.
Guys, follow me, Johnny Stofko, on all socials, no H, J-O-N-N-Y.
There you go, and I'm Tristan Cannell. Please connect with both of us or send us an email at info@thevisionboardpodcast.com if you've got any suggestions or guest requests.
Love it. Couldn't say it better.
Johnny, I'll check you next week for Siri, and you have a great weekend, man.
TK.
Peace.
Welcome to the Vision Board Podcast, stories of success from around the world.
You guys are scratching an itch, and that's why this podcast has become popular and successful, is because you guys are scratching an itch. You're enjoying it, and you're also benefiting from the knowledge that people are dropping.
I've never met the person in my life, including my parents, that was able to outwill me about me.
Whatever profession you're in, you need to keep working harder. You know, nothing comes easy these days, and you know, you'll get knocked down, but get back up, that counts, so just keep working hard at it.
You know, you guys said you do stuff, you ask things that aren't Googleable. You guys are two for two.
There's never been a time in my life where anybody ever was able to tell me who I was more than I knew who I was.
To join our vision and follow the journey, please subscribe to the Vision Board Podcast via iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher.